And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
This is the Athletic Baseball Show on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Athletic Baseball Show presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. Derek Van Riper here with Keith Law. It is Friday, June 11th. On this episode, we will discuss the biggest story around baseball right now, the sticky situation involving substances being used by pitchers around the game, players increasingly coming out and making comments about the situation and kind of adding to the level of comedy around the story, which frankly, we're all going to be sick of this sooner rather than later, but we're going to talk about it for a little while. Other big stuff that happened this week, though, Jared Kelnick was sent back to the minors by the Mariners, which got me wondering, what can teams do to help young players adapt to the big league level? Is it just demote and wait a few weeks, or could there be some future alternatives that teams will consider in similar situations? And I'm sure we'll go down a few rabbit holes along the way with so many other related topics here. But Keith, the sticky stuff, it's a problem. I agree it's a problem, but this is all Major League Baseball's fault because there is a rule on the books that the league has chosen not to enforce. And now the stuff's out of the tube, I guess, for lack of a better description, out of the can, out of the tin, out of whatever
something,
whatever holder the stuff is coming out of, or holders in the case of multiple ingredient concoctions. It's all out there right now. How on earth are they going to actually untangle this? We're seeing spin rates change back in the direction of maybe pitchers laying off some of the stuff now that there's a threat of suspensions seemingly out there. But it feels like we're far from the end of this story.
Yeah, and I'm sick of the story. I don't know about you. Not that I'm sick of people reporting on it. I don't want to cast any aspersions on journalists doing good work here. But can Major League Baseball just deal with this already? Like, really? Like, everyone acknowledges this is a problem. Well, I guess maybe some of the pitchers don't acknowledge it's a problem. Everyone else acknowledges that this is a problem. We also recognize that there are some fundamental issues with the aesthetic value of the sport right now that might not be sufficiently appealing to the mass audience that might be addressed by cracking down on use of illegal substances. There was one report, I apologize, I'm blanking on who wrote this because there's been a lot of stuff. This may have been our own Britt Girelli, who wrote about teams hiring chemists to help them design the best. Is adhesive the wrong word?
It can become an adhesive. I mean, it's right? I'm waiting for a movie scene to sort of play out on the mound where a pitcher grabs the wrong combination of goos and creates something that's too sticky and the ball doesn't come out of his hand.
Right, exactly. Or his hand comes off his entire arm. Right. I mean, this is I just keep wanting to crack the Major League, you know, Vaseline ball jokes, except that this is worse. Right? This feels worse. This isn't just life imitating art. Not that Major League is art necessarily. It might be a rather expansive use of the term, but this is all worse and more ridiculous. This is what happens when baseball doesn't crack down on minor violations, right? This is ultimately what happens. This is what happened with PEDs, regardless of your view. And I'm probably I have a little bit of a non-mainstream view on PED use in baseball, but the fact is, when it was pretty minor, there wasn't a lot of it going around. Baseball just didn't bother. And then everybody started using it. Everybody, in air quotes. More players started using it. And then suddenly it was bad enough to MLB say, oh, well, I guess now we have to do something about it. What if you just did something about it in the first place? When this started, we've all known about the stuff. Fans have been posting screenshots of this pitcher and that pitcher using what appeared to be an illegal substance for years. in Major League Baseball would kind of look into it, right? I have my hand over my eyes. People can't see this right now. He said, we don't see anything. And then it would just, the story would die until, you know, we just moved on to the next scandal. And that is how we ended up in this place, which is Major League Baseball not really doing anything, which unfortunately, I think ultimately is what characterizes Rob Manfred's tenure as commissioner. I had a scout refer to him the other day as the no-feel commissioner. And I mean, that's a pretty good summary of Manfred's tenure, right? As long as the money's coming in, doesn't really matter what else happens. No feel for the game, certainly no feel for the people who work in the game, how they may feel about things and what might happen to their careers, honestly. Is the money still coming in? Is it still green? It's not Bitcoin, right? Okay, we're good. We're good. We're happy with this. And that's going to end up, that is not a story that ends well in any for any company in any industry. Ultimately, if you count on current profit levels sustaining forever, you will not see the cliff coming. I don't know that baseball's actually headed for a cliff, but it sure seems like they're pretty complacent about the revenues and profits of the industry right now. And to me, this is just one issue. This sticky stuff issue is just one among many that could point towards a real dramatic drop off in the popularity of the sport that MLB will just simply not see coming.
Right. And I think this problem in and of itself will not make baseball's other problems disappear. There are other reasons why offense is the way it is, right? Elite positioning of defenders, shifting, different things like that, on top mm-hmm. of pitchers having as much spin and movement and velocity as they've ever had. Like, all of these factors come together to make the game what it is right now. So you're not going to undo it just by enforcing the rules you should have been enforcing all along. But you can start nudging things back in the right direction. You can nudge things back in the right direction by tweaking the baseball mm-hmm. again. How much of the changes to the baseball, because Pete Alonso had some pretty interesting comments on Wednesday suggesting that Major League Baseball changes the ball based on free agent classes. To me, that almost gives them too much credit. Like, it's such a thick sort of conspiracy. I'm like, wait a minute. They're smart, like from a business standpoint, but they're not that smart. Like, they could be diabolical, but that's a level of being diabolical that I don't even think baseball can reach.
I have two objections to that. None of this is evidence-based, right? Alonso doesn't have evidence to support the contention. I can't show you evidence to disprove the contention. I can tell you two things. One is that I absolutely do not believe MLB has that tight a control over the parameters around the construction of the baseball. They just don't. I think that's been demonstrated many times over the years. This is, to some extent, a handmade product, and Major League Baseball has just... It wasn't the thing 2 years ago. Well, it's within the, you know, accepted specification, the range of specifications for the product. And they just, it made it very clear they don't have a tight enough control over the physical characteristics of the baseball, over the manufacturing process and the baseballs that come out of it. And so assuming that they could sort of, that they have some sort of magical dial in the commissioner's office, it's turned this way to screw the free agent hitters and turn it the other way to screw the free agent pitchers. It's, you know, assuming that they could even use the dial properly, I really don't think the dial exists at all. And second is that I actually, and trust me, it's not that I don't think the owners would love to find a way to stick it to the players, but just because, like, if offense in the whole league went down in a certain year that was supposed to be a good year for free agent hitters coming out to the market, it's not that those free agent hitters will suddenly become less valuable, because everyone, it's all relative, right? Most teams now are not looking for unadjusted raw stats. Did he hit 30 home runs? It's, you know, whether you're using WAR or individual teams have different ways of calculating player values, but they all do it. And it's all relative. What was the baseline? What was average that year? What was replacement level that year? You know, this guy was had the fifth highest on-base percentage, the seventh highest ERA plus for the year. So those players are still going to get paid. Because if the whole baseline for the league changes, everyone's going to notice it. And that, I think, is ultimately the logical flaw in Alonso's argument, because such changes to the baseball aren't merely going to affect the top tier of free agents, which are, of course, the players that the owners would really most love to stick it to, because that would tend to depress the whole market. But it's going to affect everybody. Changes to the baseball will affect all hitters, or they'll affect all pitchers, or most of them, enough so that it'll just change the league averages or the league's replacement levels, and thus our offense, thus free agent valuations aren't likely to change very much off of that.
Yeah, you're right. Everyone moves up, everyone moves down when you change the ball, right? Offense goes up 20%. Well, the league's all up. Now, it might not be evenly 20% across the board for every player, but it does help the group. I think that's a fair way to debunk Pete Alonso's theory. Do you think his cynicism about the league in general is warranted, though, given the contentious relationship between the league and the players?
Yes. Yes. Any player, anyone in the union, and frankly, most fans should be very cynical about ownership and Major League Baseball. They're one and the same. Rob Manfred is not an independent contractor here, and he's not an independent agent here. And he is not, he works for the owners, and he will do the owner's bidding. And if the owners say, take a hard line with the players, then that's what he's going to do. Even if Manfred himself personally believed differently, if he personally thought it was better to have a more cordial relationship with the players and to work towards compromise, if the owner said, nope, take a hard line, that's what he's going to do. And it's pretty clear to me that's what the owners are doing, because they have become so miserly across the sport with teams cutting area scouts who were underpaid to begin with to save $500,000 a year total from all the area scouts they're cutting, when the value, you know, I did that 2011 redraft last week and talked about Zach Davies, who was the 35th round pick or something, a high school pick. And he's had quite a major league career, generated millions of dollars in value for the teams that have employed him, except the Orioles, who originally drafted him, let go of the scout, John Gillette, who drafted Davies out of high school a couple of years ago. And Gillette, currently, I just talked to him the other day, he has not latched on with another team. That one pick, that one player that he found, nobody else found that player. The computers do not find that high school player in the 35th round who ends up generating millions in surplus value. That justified Gillette's salary for years and years. And look, not all area scouts are created equal. Not every area scout is going to find a Zach Davies somewhere late in the draft, but if you don't have any area scouts, you don't even give yourself the opportunity to find those guys. And the fact that owners are just that cheap at this point, there's no other word for it. They are just that cheap. You and I were talking the other day, is it possible they're not going to have the Arizona Fall League? Weren't we talking about that? You asked about the Arizona Fall League. I was talking to someone else on the phone. Then you posted a message in Slack, has anyone heard about the Arizona Fall League? You know what my fear is? They're going to say, yeah, we don't make money off of that. Just cancel it. It's a trivial amount of money. Teams love the Arizona Fall League. They love to scout it, and they love to send players there for development. And especially with so many players missing time last year because the season didn't happen, then missing time this year because a lot of players are having non-traumatic injuries, but missing time because players are just getting hurt more, that's an opportunity to catch up on some more of the lost playing time. But will Major League Baseball actually hold the Arizona Fall League? I haven't heard anything yet, and that makes me very nervous. So if I'm in Alonso's shoes, I'm looking at ownership and saying, man, if they're going this cheap on tiny costs relative to the overall cost of the industry, what the heck is their attitude going to be towards me, Pete Alonso, rookie of the year, guy who's probably going to be making $10 million a year pretty soon, guy who's really going to get paid in arbitration for sure, given his counting stats. What am I thinking about this? Well, those owners are probably going to try to find any way to pay me less that they possibly can. And I would be preemptively angry about it and getting to the union and saying, we better fight, because they're coming for a fight. We cannot show up. What's the song by the Wombats, British band I like? I brought a lemon to a knife fight. Okay? The players union cannot bring a lemon to the knife fight, because that's kind of what they did 5 years ago and it didn't work.
Yeah, bring a pointy fruit like a pineapple or a star fruit.
What about pointed sticks? I know what you're doing. I know what you're doing. We are reasonably old white men. The Monty Python references were obligatory.
So all of this frustrates me as a fan and an analyst and someone who generally just loves baseball, because the powers that be that can profit from this have the ability to nip this problem in the bud and change the dialogue and change the perception of the game and take the people who are not baseball fans, who only get exposure to the top headlines from baseball on like a SportsCenter show or just general news in general, and all they get is this negativity about sticky stuff instead of the amazing stories. We talked about Vlad Jr. a few weeks ago. He's ascended to stardom. Mm-hmm. We could talk about Marcus Semien being an incredible signing by the Jays. I mean, look at the season he's having. Jesse Winker is mashing. The Giants have turned a bunch of old guys that we all thought were done mm-hmm. into great hitters again. We could be talking about any and all of those things day after day after day, and instead the game, the league, is shooting itself in the foot. And I think that's the part that bothers me the most, because they would make money if they took care of the problem. They'll make more money promoting the amazing game that is actually being played on the field, even with its flaws, if they can just change the narrative and solve a problem that they have a rule for.
That goes back to the Bud Selig era. Since the moment that Bud Selig took over as commissioner after the coup d'etat that got Faye Vincent out of office, baseball's general MO has been to try to... Their messaging has been very consistent. The players make too much money and it's ruining the sport. It's amazing we still have fans after 25 plus years of Major League Baseball trashing its own product like that. And I have to tip my hat here to Joe Sheehan, who has been banging that drum longer than anybody. But that was what Bud Selig did, and it's one of the things that has been continuous from Selig's reign to Manfred's reign. When Manfred took over, I was optimistic. I had met him, I had spoken to him. I actually thought he genuinely liked baseball more than Selig did. That's no longer clear to me. And I thought it was a new voice. It was a chance for them to change the narrative. You can still run this like a business and still be a fairly, take more of a hard line as a business person without publicly trashing your product. But this is constant. It is constant. Now, the stories about the players making too much money are not as frequent as they used to be. But instead, it's all of these other things that are wrong with the sport, right? How many times has Rob Manfred talked about pace of play? You can look into pace of play. All you have to do is get rid of some of the commercials and pace of play problem solved. They're never going to do that. But stop talking about it. Stop telling people that the pace of play is too slow. Just stop saying that to people and it'll go away. But if you feed into this, then of course people are going to continue to talk about it. And we have so much of that coming from Major League Baseball and not enough of what Major League Baseball does well, for example, on social media, for example. I follow many MLB runner affiliated accounts from MLB to Cut Forward, the Pipeline. They're doing a pretty good job of getting highlights out there and talking up certain players and making sure we see, even folks like you and me, we do this for a living. We don't see every game. We don't see every play. But if you follow the right feeds, you're going to see a lot of stuff. It might be, I didn't realize that so-and-so just had, Cedric Mullins just had 9 hits in a row at some point. I think it was actually over the weekend. I'm probably a little out of date already on this, but I barely know what day it is today. But you know what? That's the kind of thing that they should be doing. They're doing a good job. The folks, often very young folks, who are running those social media accounts, they're getting it right at the micro level. But Major League Baseball as an entity is not doing a good enough job at the macro level. And I think you're right. It is too much of this kind of talk, too much of this negative talk. And allowing the sticky stuff story, we need a better name for this. Got to be right. Arrested Development. There's just got to be a better way to say that. You need to get out in front of that narrative and not let that take over. It's ridiculous the number of stories by national baseball writers we have seen in the last week that have talked about this. Not that, again, they're doing the right thing by covering it, but it should never have gotten to this point in the first place.
Exactly.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
I'm glad you brought up Mullins, because Mullins is a fun player to talk about for a bunch of different reasons. The interesting thing for me with Cedric Mullins, Keith, he gave up switch hitting. And switch hitting has to be one of the hardest things to do in professional sports. have two swings that you could use to hit the best pitching we've probably ever seen in baseball history. Like, mm-hmm. That's almost impossible to do. And I think it tricks me as an analyst looking back through numbers if I don't break out numbers by split.
Yep.
If I don't look and see, oh, actually, he's terrible hitting from the left side and he's great from the right side. I think Ozzie Albies is another example of this. Albies hits really well from the right side and is just kind of okay from the left side. If you don't really notice that, you see kind of average or slightly above average numbers and you think, oh, I know what this guy is. Mullins is reaching this new level because he's completely changed his approach as a hitter. He's literally only hitting from one side now. Did you ever think this sort of level was possible when you go back and think about your previous evaluations of Mullins as a prospect coming through the Orioles system? Because, I mean, a 13th round pick in 2015, this is a success story, just having him in the big leagues as a good player, but he looks like he's going to be a little bit more than that.
Yeah, he was always, I feel like I had him on my Orioles lists for a while, but never close to anything like this. And I'm not sold on this as a sustainable level for Mullins, too. There's definitely, like, first of all, he's been hitting out of his mind the last 10 days or so. And that maybe there's some strong recency bias going on. Not only is he hitting out of his mind, but he's made a couple of really, really great plays in center field. So, like, I don't want to fall too prey to the recency bias there. And also, they're looking at some of his underlying data. There's some flukiness in it, sure. I don't think he's going to hold this level. But I actually, if you hadn't brought it up, I would have brought it up. The number one thing that makes me think he can be better than anyone, I'm pretty sure anyone thought he would be, is that he gave up switch hitting. And I have a very hard to test hypothesis, but that's when a player like that gives up switch hitting, when there's been a huge struggle from one side, that when they give up that the side that it's not working from, that they have a real chance to get better from the other side. You know, the immediate assumption is, well, if he didn't give up hitting right-handed, now he's going to hit left-handed against lefties and he's going to be horrible at that. Well, in his case, he was horrible against lefties no matter what. But maybe now he's not trying to keep two swings straight. Maybe now he's spending more time, instead of spending time in the cage working on a right-handed swing that was never going to work, he could spend all his time in the cage just hitting left-handed. And I would think, not just from a practice perspective, but from a neurological perspective, right? That's different. That is actually different muscle memory that you're trying to build. You're doing things with your offhand tends to build more neural connections. So, are you freeing yourself up, freeing more brain power, reducing your cognitive load by not trying to switch hit? And it's why it's so frustrating when I see, I will always think of Billy Hamilton as, it's not clear he was ever going to be a great hitter, but if the Reds hadn't tried to make him a switch hitter, gotten him hitting left-handed, is the narrative of his career very different? Is the whole story different? It's just, okay, yeah, we wish you were left-handed, but just hit right-handed. Just focus on hitting right-handed and run like hell. Is his arc different? I'm always going to believe that it would be.
I'd be curious to ask Billy Hamilton about this. How many coaches did he have who just leaned so heavily into the speed, which is ridiculous compared against other pros? But imagine Billy Hamilton on every field he played on his way to becoming a professional ball player. He would have been the fastest person you've ever seen, like the fastest human ever. How many people gave him bad advice about his approach as a hitter because of that incredible tool? A nice level swing, hit the ball on the ground, leg it out. I mean, I'm sure Billy Hamilton was getting bad advice much, much longer than he should have been because of that one particular gift.
He was always a challenging prospect for me because he was a Mississippi high school kid. I've talked ad nauseum about quality of high school baseball in Mississippi is just not good. And position players drafted out of Mississippi have a horrible track record in the draft. They don't hit. And Hamilton, on top of that, so that's your base rate. He's a Mississippi high school prospect. Hamilton was pretty raw and pretty undersized as a hitter to begin with. And he's never had a lot of strength. It's always been a challenge for him. And it's one reason I always struggled with him as a prospect. He was remains, I think, the fastest guy I've ever personally clocked. I know Byron Buxton has had faster sprint speeds in the majors, but in myself, home to first, Hamilton still has the record. And yet, if he had not had the additional challenges, so he already had challenges, right? He was coming with less less experience, had not faced as much good hitting in high school, good pitching in high school, and was really undersized and had issues where he just never seemed to have enough hand or forearm strength to make quality contact. Add to that, oh, by the way, we're also going to ask you to switch hit. Was that one thing too many? Meant too many for him? Was he never going to hit anyway? And the switch hitting thing was just, you know, it's just pile more on top of it, but it doesn't matter. I don't know, right? That's the thing we can never prove. But I certainly would like to know what Billy Hamilton's career would look like if he had just never tried, if they, the Reds had never tried to make him a switch hitter in the first place. And by the way, the reason they tried to make him a switch hitter was, imagine how many extra hits he'll get as a left-handed hitter with that speed, which to me is a couple. But what if it just, as it turns out, because it's easy to say now, right? He's, God, how old? He's 30. He's already 30. We are really getting old, Derek. Well, you know, how many right-handed hits did he not get because of all the time he had to spend trying to learn to switch hit as a 19-year-old? Which, at that point, it's, you know, you might also argue that's really late to try to learn to be a switch hitter.
Yeah, and I think the other thing with Hamilton, too, like a lot of young players, he moved around defensively a little bit, too, right? When he broke in, he was an infielder. He was playing shortstop.
He was a very bad shortstop. That's not his fault, and that's not the Reds' fault, but he was never going to stick at shortstop. I'll give the Reds a little credit. When they finally switched him, they just said, I was out in the fall league that year. I don't know if you got out there that same year, but I think I was there the week they moved him to center field, and it was, whoa, okay, nobody should look that good their first time ever playing center field. And it wasn't just speed. I mean, Joey Gathright could run like hell. He just might be running in the wrong direction. But Hamilton looked like he knew where to go immediately, and it was incredibly impressive. So it's not like he was without feel or without instincts necessarily. But I'm sorry, I feel like I'm repeating myself here. It's just, would it have been different if there was one fewer thing for him to try to figure out? And by the way, oh, as you mentioned, he also had to figure out a new position. Well, he did that really well, but still, add that to the pile of things that he had to learn just to get to be a major league quality player.
Yeah, Hamilton in the fall league that year was ridiculous. He put on a clinic in the fall stars game or rising stars game. What's the preferred nomenclature for the showcase?
I think it's the rising stars game. They still call it
rising stars game.
Yeah. Dude, I just hope it happens. You can call it anything. Let's just have it this year. That's all I ask.
It is my favorite part of the year.
Oh, it's awesome.
To be in Arizona. And it's the best opportunity. If you're someone like me who doesn't get on the road to watch prospects in season, you'll see as many good prospects in one place as you can possibly see over the span of a few days. Yeah. And if you go for that weekend, it's a great weekend. It's not crowded. I mean, that game can sell out, but every other fall league game you go to is a couple hundred people. So pick your seat for about $8. It's a great experience.
And it would be loaded this year. I'm 100% believe that league will be stuffed with talent if they hold it this year. If it's nothing more than the same six teams that they've generally always had, and the same, and they go back to the shorter schedule, right? 2 years ago, I think they moved it up a little bit. Just do the basic fall league and do the Rising Stars game. It's going to be a scout's paradise, which for teams want that. They want those players to be scouted. They want those players playing in Salt River where the TrackMan, if they're, you know, whatever the system is now, StatCast system is turned on and they can gather that data. I mean, there's huge value in having that out there. It is so great. I've told fans for years, it's a great place to go. And if you say, well, what players should I be looking at? Kind of all of them, right? Mm-hmm. Most of them are going to end up playing in the big leagues at some point. Some may just be up and down guys, but a whole lot of them are going to make it. And a lot of those guys are going to be guys who make it. You've probably had the same experience where it's 4 or 5 years later and one of those guys will pop up in the big leagues. I'll say, oh my God, I forgot. Wow, that guy made it, huh? But I saw him. I know I saw him somewhere in one of these notebooks. I have a note on seeing so-and-so pitch an inning or two, and they just bounced around, needed the right opportunity, found a little more velocity somewhere, and they get there. And so if you look back at old fall league rosters, it is a justification for the league's existence how many of those guys end up in the big leagues.
Yeah, truly a finishing school for a lot of players that are knocking on the door of being big league ready, and a league that, if it continues, hopefully will get more promotion. I've always wondered why the fall league isn't treated like an experimental broadcasting opportunity for the league too. I mean, MLB Network could run those games for next to nothing. Mm-hmm. They could try any number of people calling games. It could be minor leaguers looking for minor league play-by-play people looking for more opportunities. It could be literally anyone, and it'd be fun because there's nothing mm-hmm. else to watch baseball-wise that time of year, especially during the day. Let's get to some other big stories from the week, specifically Jared Kelnick. sent back to the minors after basically a three-series slump, Keith. The K rate jumped up to about 40%. He had an 0-for-39 stretch. And I think I can completely rationalize why you'd send a player back down. He didn't have a ton of experience in the upper levels of the minor leagues, of course, because of the canceled season last year. Mm-hmm. I kind of compared this to what St. Louis did with Dylan Carlson last year. You might remember Dylan Carlson went to the alternate site for about 10 days in September, came back up. He's been up ever since. Since that time, he's been about 20% better than a league average hitter. Before that demotion, he was brutal. He struck out a ton, wasn't walking much, didn't look like the Dylan Carlson that we saw in the minor leagues. So I think the main question I have for you is, when you look at a player like Kelnick or like Carlson and they struggle initially, is the demotion back to AAA really the best option? Or could there be something that's more in line with, hey, you're getting a series off, but you're going to stay with the big league coaches, you're going to stay around the veterans, and we're going to ease you back into the lineup? Like, why do we go from you're playing almost every day, you're going to start 21 of your first 24 games, you're going to lead off a bunch of those games, to actually, you're not quite ready, you're going back to Tacoma? And again, putting aside service time issues, because I don't think this is about service time at this point.
No, not this time.
I think they truly believe this is the right thing to do. And I'm wondering if there's other things teams should be doing instead of just demoting young players at the first whiff of failure.
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm going to punt a little bit and say the answer probably varies by player and by what's going on. You know, in Kelnick's case, he was 0 for like 2 weeks, right? It was some horrible streak. That was not entirely his fault either. A lot of it had just been bad luck. But I also, you know, this is one of those cases where I will defer to the people who are in the clubhouse and in the front office that they might know the kid. They're seeing the kid. They're talking to the kid. And if you think he's starting to maybe lose some confidence, do you send him back down and say, look, you're going to go rake in Tacoma? Obviously, everyone thinks Kelnick's going to go back down and just mash in AAA for a while and let him get some confidence back. It might only be 2 weeks. Or just stop the skid and come bring him back after hopefully he goes down there and hits 380 with some bombs for a couple of weeks, and then you just turn around, bring him back up, and he's just hit a mental reset button. You know, that's in Kelenic's case, where I don't think there was anything fundamentally wrong with him. He had some bad luck and then probably was starting to, you know, change his approach a little bit, but it wasn't, you know, we've had a bunch of pitchers come up this year. We've talked a little bit, I think, about Daniel Lynch at one point, who came up. He wasn't really throwing anywhere near enough strikes. His stuff was fine. His velocity was there. But you know what? If his command and control aren't ready for the big leagues, well, you're going to go back down. This is what you need to work on. We need to see, you know, this percent of your pitches must be thrown for strikes. We need to see this kind. Obviously, you have very precise pitch data. We want to see fastballs located in this portion of the zone, this quadrant, or this area of the zone. There are very specific, almost deliverables you could give a player in that situation and tell him, you have some agency here. We'll call you back up once you meet all these criteria. We're just laying this out for you and saying you're not coming back out until you do so. And to me, that would be, you know, for that type of player where the major league competition showed you that something was lacking in this player's game right now. I don't think any less of Lynch or Kelenic as long-term prospects now, but for different reasons, they just weren't able to produce right away. And that means that there should be different approaches to their development going forward.
Right. I do think you're absolutely on point to just acknowledge the fact that every player is going to be different. Some guys, they go into a slump like this and they're grinding the bat into sawdust because they just keep gripping it tighter and they can't hit reset. Other players handle it better. And I think in Kelnick's case, I mean, this is probably the first time he's had a stretch like this or anything even close to this in his career. So you do have to err on the side of believing the team doing what they're doing. It strikes me as odd because you go through this process, you evaluate a player for a few years in your system, and you have to make this difficult call. When is he truly ready? And again, this isn't about service time. We're just talking about a pure evaluation standpoint. Mm-hmm. I think it's more difficult right now than it would be in any other year to know if a player is truly big league ready because of the missing piece that is 2020. I think you do have to make more of a leap if you're in a front office right now when you decide to promote a player, because you just have a significant part of the track record that is not there. And I think it's even more difficult to make this decision for a position player than it is with a pitcher. Because with a pitcher, you can look at underlying pitch characteristics. You can look at velo and movement and spin, and you can say, this guy has three pitches that he commands that move like big league caliber pitching. We can move him up. Like an Alek Manoah, it's easier to probably make that call on than it is for a hitter of any kind.
Yes, I agree. I think it's generally easier for pitchers. There are exceptions. Obviously, there's always, you know, the Daniel Lynch, obviously, the Jackson Coar, too. The Royals have had a couple of guys they've brought up and maybe thought were ready, and the very, very short-term data said, nope, actually, they're not quite ready, unfortunately. But I do think it's easier to look at a pitcher and say, well, this guy's, you know, the stuff is there. It meets various criteria, and he's throwing enough strikes. We think this guy will come up and miss enough bats, for example, that he'll be able to, even if he struggles initially, he'll be able to muddle through. But I also think the broader point, and this is probably a testable hypothesis that I just have not figured out a good way. I'm, you know, I don't really think I'm not the data person I used to be, clearly, the data scientist, if I ever was one. I never really was one. But anyway, this is a testable hypothesis and a challenge for anyone listening. Is the gap between the minors and the majors in terms of quality of competition larger now than it's ever been? I feel like it is. Now, maybe that's temporary because of what you said, that 2020 was just, you know, was a cipher. So many of these guys didn't play. But I feel like we are seeing more guys come up and struggle out of the gate, more highly touted guys with strong track records of success come up and struggle out of the gate. Now, maybe temporary, may only be 2 or 3 weeks of struggle, it may be 2 or 3 starts, but whatever it is, that they are struggling. And I would say that's probably because the caliber of play in the major leagues is the highest that it's ever been. And also they're using more sticky stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that adds to it. Clearly. But you're talking about the best positioned, most talented defenders we've ever had, mm-hmm. right? I mean, that makes it harder to turn balls in play into hits. It's just the nature of the game right now. Mm-hmm. I wonder if part of this comes back to expectations, though, too, because we have some players who come in with lower expectations who initially put up decent numbers, and that can fool us the other direction. Like, just as you can look at Kelnick right now and say, yeah, he's not quite big league ready, which it's hard to say that he is in the face of the slump that he just had. I get that. You can more easily look at Trevor Larnach right now and go, wow, yeah, he really is big league ready. And the truth is probably closer to, eh, he still might not be, but he's holding his own and then some for now. Wait and see what happens in the next 4 to 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. And we could be talking about the same sort of thing with Larnach going to St. Paul in the middle of July if he goes into some kind of prolonged slump. It just seems like we want more immediate results with prospects than we're ever going to get. That's part of the problem too. Like, our own expectations, again, as fans and analysts, like, we want players to be ready immediately, right out of the box. We want Acuñas and Sotos to be every prospect. That's just not how it works.
Right. No, that is a huge problem. Mike Trout made his debut in 2011. Okay, this is probably the best player in Major League history. And he got 135 plate appearances in 40 games. He was a 19-year-old, obviously, so that was aggressive. But seemingly completely warranted by what he'd done in the minors. He hit .220 with a .281 on base percentage and a .390 slug. He struck out 30 times against 9 walks. He had a couple of homers. He had 5 homers in 40 games. Obviously, that's really good. But otherwise, there was just nothing about that little stint in the majors to make you think this is Willie Mays, right? That this guy is actually going to be the best player in Major League history. And then when he came back, I think the next May or so, obviously for the rest of that year, he won the Rookie of the Year. He was a runner-up 2 straight years in the MVP voting. He should have won the MVP both of those years, but writers are still really, really distracted by shiny things like RBIs. Trout struggled 40 games, a 40-game sample in his first rookie year. He was still rookie eligible the next year, but his first stint in the majors for 40 games, he struggled. So any player who comes up and struggles for 40 games, for 50 games, for 30, whatever, some fraction of a season, you gotta, you know, just ease up. These guys can still turn out to be superstars. I don't remember this happening, but there had to be people after Trout's first, because Trout was demoted in that first season. There had to be people saying, this kid's not that good. And I mean, that would be the coldest take of all time, I would say.
Yeah, and I think when you go back, I mean, 2012 was almost a 30-50 season. He missed it by one steal. Mm-hmm. He hit .326, .399, .564 as a 20-year-old. For a 19-year-old rookie to not completely fall on his face,
yeah,
that's amazing.
Yep.
An 87 WRC plus means you're 13% below a league average hitter. If you do that at the big league level as a teenager, that is success. You are good.
He would have been 30. He almost certainly would have been 30, 50. He came up, I guess, at the end of April. He missed about 23 games that year. He had played 139 games that year. So, yeah, you're right. As a 20-year-old and as a 19, you just look at the contrast between what he did that year as a 20-year-old and what he did in the 40 games as a 19-year-old. And okay, not everybody's Mike Trout, but if Mike Trout can struggle like that and then obviously then still turn into Mike Trout, we shouldn't give up on any player in the first 30 or 50 games, nor should we overrate a player who comes up and plays extremely well in his first 30 or 40 games. We need a lot more time than that. Now, if we thought the player was going to be a star based on what he did in the minors, and then he comes up in those first 30 or 40 games appear to be in line with what he did in the minors, great. You should have a higher level of confidence in that player. But also keep in the back of your mind, this may not be it, right? This is not necessarily, it's not necessarily all uphill from here, all, you know, straight up from here. There could be ups and downs. This player, there will be an adjustment to this player, and this player will make an adjustment back. And there could be some vicissitudes in his career, you know, over the next couple of weeks or next couple of months. But I think my general point is, you know, we shouldn't be giving up on players after fairly small samples. And if that means if that player has to go back down at some point, Kelenic could go back down and come up and be a superstar. He could be a superstar in the second half of the season. That would not surprise me at all. And it would not really be contradicted by what we saw from him in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, and thinking about it with a practical example of a rookie who's played really well when he's been on the field this season, Jazz Chisholm. It's too early to take a Jazz Chisholm victory lap. Like, what we're seeing is really exciting.
I'm sorry, I'm already taking that. Do I need to stop?
he's still got K rate near 33%. Yeah. He's going to go through growing pains. It's inevitable. Just with that approach that he brings, he will go through prolonged slumps.
Yep.
Most players go through slumps anyway. That approach leads to some prolonged slumps. So you temper the expectations accordingly, even though the beginning of this season has been outstanding.
I would look at him as a player who, you know what? He's played well. He's shown you what he's capable of doing. He still has work to do. There's still development required there. Now, I happen to think he's going to do it because I think he's pretty high aptitude. He's so athletically gifted. And he's already made adjustments. To me, the number one indicator of will you be able to make adjustments in the future is have you made adjustments in the past? So I think he's going to do it. But I also, I've ranked Chisholm very highly multiple times on my prospect rankings. At the same time, I fully acknowledge he may never make those adjustments. He may not be capable of it. This swing and miss issue may always be with him, and it will limit his ceiling. So it is. I agree with you on that case, but I'm still going to take, can I take just a small victory lap? Just like a little?
At least you got to wait till the All-Star break to take a victory lap.
Derek.
It's a little early. You got one more month.
Why do you hate victory laps?
I love victory laps. I just hate early victory laps. That's all. You got to make it through the season. You got to see how the whole thing comes together. Sorry. Yeah, I don't make the rules. I'm just here to enforce them.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic.
See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
When you get injured, you don't want to wait for answers and options. That's why it may be time to explore the Nano Experience, a revolutionary treatment option designed to help active people get back to the lifestyles they love. Nanotechnology allows surgeons to see inside even the smallest joints and treat orthopedic conditions with a tiny camera and other nano instrumentation, all through a barely there poke hole incision. Wherever you've experienced an injury, whether it be a foot and ankle, hand and wrist, shoulder and elbow, knee or hip, nanoarthroscopy can be used to diagnose and treat your condition in an extremely, minimally invasive way. Don't wait to learn about the revolutionary Nano experience and how it could help you or someone you know after an injury. Visit arthrex.info/theathletic. This is not medical advice and is not meant to be a substitute for advice from your physician. Talk with your physician about your health condition, potential surgical risks, and whether Arthrex products are right for you. Postoperative management is patient-specific and dependent upon your physician's assessment. Individual results will vary. Let's talk about the Giants for a moment. I teased this a little bit earlier. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've done some things with their hitters that I honestly didn't think were possible. And there's a few ways you can look at it. You can look at just this season. You can look at their overall performance as a team hitting. I mean, they're sixth in team WRC plus right now. Like you wouldn't have expected that coming into the season unless you were fully buying into what they were doing a year ago, which maybe was more of a sign of things to come than I believed it was. If you Frankenstein 2020 and 2021 together, it's further proof that what the Giants are doing right now, at least it looks like further proof, it's not a fluke. Like this is an organization that has changed some things with their approach, with their bats, and they are getting much better results. Is this one of the more overlooked stories in the game this season? Because the Giants have also put themselves in a position where their playoff odds, according to Fangraphs, is entering play on Thursday, are above 50%. Just absolutely ridiculous. 56.4% chance to make the playoffs for a San Francisco team that if you projected them to win more than 81 games this year, I think you're probably a Giants fan.
Yes, yes, I would agree with that. I don't know. Buster Posey, Brandon Crawford, these guys have just, and Evan, especially Evan Longoria, that might be the most surprising one of all, right? These guys are back from the dead. Now, in Posey's case, he got hurt and then he opted out of last season. The other two guys just look like they're periods as highly productive major league players just look like they were over. And Crawford is 34, Longoria is 35. Obviously, Longoria is on the IL right now, but these guys looked pretty close to toast. And both those guys have turned into extremely productive hitters in ways that look reasonably sustainable. And I know there have been attempts, you know, the Giants are since Gabe Kapler got there, they've preached some new hitting, some different things on approach, some different things on swing paths. And some of that has come through. I also see some things on that team that are maybe not as sustainable. And the question is, how much of this is, look, you got Donovan Solano, that fairy dust appears to have worn off there. Mike Yastrzemski, another one who's really fallen off. Alex Dickerson, both of the latter two players are on the injured list, along with Darren Ruff. These are a lot of guys who had nice little surges that didn't really, I didn't really know if we should buy in. They have not performed like that this year. And so I wonder how much of this, if your offense is really powered by just three or four guys, and a couple of whom look like, even if you love Crawford and Longoria and say, yep, it's going to stay, they are going to be like this for the next year or two, they're still old. They're going to get hurt. They're going to miss time. There's going to be some slippage. I don't know how much I can fully buy into that. They're clearly a better team than we thought they were. Are they really, aren't they like a 600 winning percentage team right now? Like, are they really that? And you can make some similar arguments on the pitching side where, is Kevin Gausman really going to have a buck and a quarter ERA the entire year, even if he stays healthy, which I certainly, and I've been a Gausman guy for a long time, thought he just had to get away from Buck Showalter and that Orioles coaching staff that just kept messing with where he was on the rubber. Are they all going to pitch like that for the rest of the year? I would probably bet on some regression. The thing that if I were a Giants fan right now, I would hold on to is, hey, we've won a whole lot of games already. 44 more wins puts us above 500 just the rest of the way. It's not hard to see them put, what if they play 500 the rest of the way? They're probably still a playoff team or very close to it. And you could certainly make an argument, okay, they may not be a 600 winning percentage team the rest of the way, but they should win more games than they lose the rest of the way. That puts them in the playoffs. And, it doesn't matter whether we think they were really they're a 38-win team right now. Were they really a 38-win team? Has this been fluky? Is this likely? It doesn't matter, right? They have those wins. We're deep enough into the season that I think it's reasonable to start talking about that. Even if this is just a 500 team on paper, that probably still puts them in the playoffs.
Yeah, if you're a 500 team that gets lucky for a 60-game stretch, yes, that is enough to be a wild card team.
You could be a World Series team.
And they're not they're not the type of team that's going to sit idly by and, and fail to make acquisitions. If they see something out there they can do that gives them a better chance to win, they'll spend some money. They'll go do it.
You know what else, too? Like, their Jake McGee has been a revelation in their bullpen. Like, that's a find. That's a good job, right? That's a guy who was a little lost in the wilderness because he went to Colorado, and Colorado's obviously not a great place to pitch. They've just had a lot of bullpen issues to begin with. Yeah, DeSclafani, a guy who just looked like, you know, he'd been hurt for so long. It'd been so long since he'd been an effective major league starter, but they get him back, and it turns out he's really, this is probably the best consistent stretch of pitching we've seen from DeSclafani, maybe ever, and otherwise pretty close to it. Oh, God, that whole rotation, other than Cueto, who was already there, it's all guys who they, no, I take that back. Logan Webb, who's on the IL now too, but he was one of their own prospects. Alec Wood, DeSclafani, Gossman, all off the scrap heap, basically. Low dollar signings, 1 year signings, who they've acquired, or guys they acquired just to, hey, let's fill out a rotation. I don't think any of those guys is going to suddenly turn around and be terrible. I don't want anyone to say, to think that that's what I'm saying. Do I think we'll get less from some of these guys, the majority of these guys going forward? That's probably true. In Wood's case, it might be more that he's just never really stayed healthy for a full season. In Gossman's case, I love Gossman. He's not going to have a buck and a quarter ERA the rest of the year unless he's using the best sticky stuff of anybody.
Which very well might be, no longer an option at this point. But the way it looks for me, okay, the Giants are atop the NL West while we're speaking right now. I don't think either of us expect them to stay there. That's a little over their skis. But 50-50 almost to make the playoffs. It'd basically be them versus the teams that don't win the NL Central, which right now the contenders there, Brewers, Cubs, Cardinals. So two of those three teams, the Giants, and then you've got the NL East, which is turning into a total mess right now. Those teams are lagging well behind the Dodgers, Padres, and Giants wins-wise. So you're probably not getting a wild card out of the NL East, barring a couple of surging teams in that division. It doesn't seem that hard to talk yourself into the Giants actually being better than a lot of those teams when the dust settles at the end of the year.
Yeah, and speaking of the NL East, Atlanta looks like they're finally starting to play like a contender. Yeah, I wonder, is that just Atlanta and the Mets down the stretch? The Mets get healthy enough, and Atlanta is, again, starting to play up to their, you know, up to their, certainly up to their fans' expectations after kind of a slow-ish start. I think both those teams are going to need to make some acquisitions, and they may just beat the heck out of each other, but get beaten up on, you know, Washington's not terrible. Philadelphia's not terrible. They're good enough to cause a lot of trouble. Whereas, at least in the NL West, you've got three apparently very good teams and two not very good teams where, I mean, as we were recording this, the Diamondbacks dismissed their hitting coaches, their main and assistant hitting coaches, which, as you know, is going to solve all their problems. So, you know, there are schedule reasons to think the Giants have a better chance and the Padres and the Dodgers. And they're, you know, and the fact that the NL Central is just generally weak, do I think the Giants could end up with a better record than any team other than, you know, any of the non-division winners in the other two divisions? Yeah. Yeah, it's entirely possible. And a lot of it just comes down to them having that 15 win. They're 15 games over 500 right now as we're recording this. Again, that doesn't just, you don't have to give those back. Just playing 500 the rest of the way gives them what they beat, about 88, 89 wins on the season. That probably makes you a playoff team.
Yeah, I think for me, if it doesn't happen, it's probably because the injuries are going to catch up to them. It's an old roster with a lot of guys, yeah, especially the pitching staff that's dealt with a ton of injuries. If that catches up to them on top of inevitable regression anyway, back towards being a 500-ish sort of team, that's how they fall out of that position. But it's not a total fluke, and definitely one of the better storylines in the league this season, and one that people just don't talk that much about because the Giants were so good for so long. We just didn't expect them to make another run with some of those core pieces still in place. That is going to wrap things up for this episode of The Athletic Baseball Show. Before we go, I should say, check out this week's episode of The Keith Law Show. Dr. Peter Hotez was the guest, talking a lot about the pandemic and obviously some baseball talk in there too, but really insightful conversation that Keith had with him. New subscribers can join The Athletic for $3.99 a month at theathletic.com/baseballshow. If you're enjoying this show, take a moment to leave us a nice rating and review. And if you got a friend who might enjoy it, tell them about the show as well. We'd really appreciate that. You can hear me on Rates and Barrels and our full suite of fantasy baseball shows. You can find Keith on Twitter at Keith Law. You can find me at Derek Van Riper. The Athletic Baseball Show is back on Monday. Have a great weekend.